Once again, Florida lawmakers have missed a deadline and they will not get the state's budget done in time for Friday's end of the legislative session. Why? It's a fight over funding for the state's hospitals. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio at 9 and also make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we speak with UF Health Jacksonville CEO Dr. Leon Haley on this 11th hour fight over hospital funding. How will it impact this city's only safety net hospital, UF Health? Get on the line now with your calls and thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, Toxic Charity author Robert Lupton, plus a look at MoCA's new project, Atrium Artist, all of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, Florida's regular 60-day legislative session will end Friday with no budget agreement. That means lawmakers could be held over into Saturday and maybe even into next week. What's going on? Well, it appears disagreements over hundreds of millions of dollars in hospital funding are what's holding things up in Tallahassee right now. The Florida House and Florida Senate are butting heads. They are at odds on how to reimburse the state's 200-plus hospitals for Medicaid patients. Now, the Senate plan would take money away from public hospitals like Jacksonville's own UF Health. And how all of this shakes out could have a major impact on this region's only safety net hospital. We want to get a closer look at how that could affect patient care. So right now, we're pleased to welcome UF Health Jacksonville CEO, Dr. Leon Haley. He's following the debate very closely, and he joins us by phone. Dr. Haley, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
Well, thanks. And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts and comments about this delay for the end of the state legislative session? Keep in mind, this is the second year in a row that lawmakers have needed extra time to pass a budget, their only constitutional responsibility, by the way. What are your questions about the funding for the state's hospitals? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we welcome your comments always on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Dr. Leon Haley, CEO of UF Health in Jacksonville, it appears that lawmakers are stuck because they're opposed. The leadership of the House and Senate are opposed on how to reimburse Florida's hospitals for Medicaid. What are the differences between the House and Senate proposals as you understand them?
Well, I think the important thing, and you mentioned this a little earlier, is this is the second year in a row that there's been significant debate around the funding formulas between the House and Senate and how to reimburse for Medicaid. Last year, UF Health had to absorb a $22 million impact, negative impact to our bottom line, which for us, you know, doesn't impact patient care, but it really hurts our ability to invest in our infrastructure. This year, the House and Senate are having the same debate about the reimbursement formulas and whether the money should follow the patient. The problem with the Senate formula right now is it does have a significant impact on the safety net institutions across the state and including us.
So it sounds as though the Florida House wants to keep the current funding model in place. The Senate would like to apportion more money to for-profit hospitals. Is that a simplistic way, I guess, of summarizing what's happening here?
I think the House would like to keep the formula the same, very current to what it is right now. The Senate formula changes it. So not so much it benefits one hospital or another, but it tends to follow the patient. When that model is used, then the safety net hospitals take a significant impact.
Right. And so this proposal then would draw dollars away from safety net hospitals like UF Health Jacksonville. You're the region's only safety net hospital. You would treat anyone whether or not they can afford to pay. And it would increase Medicaid payments, spread them around more toward all hospitals. What's the argument for doing that?
Well, the argument that the other hospitals are making is that they're obviously contributing to the overall health of the state, and that they take care of a significant portion of Medicaid patients as well, and that the model ought to support that. But to your point, it does draw away from the safety net, which creates challenges for those hospitals like ours who support level one care, they support burn care, significant parts of the educational process. So medical students and residents are part of our hospital milieu, and so they're all affected by our ability to not have the right reimbursement models.
We've heard for years that UF Health, many still think of it as Shands, but of course you're now UF Health Jacksonville, has really been operating on thin margins when it comes to this issue and had been concerned about this funding formula for some time in terms of your ability to keep your doors open, treat everyone who comes through the door. How deep do your concerns run? Dr. Haley, tell us a little bit about the numbers here and what your biggest concern is about how this budget is going to affect your system, your hospital system.
You know, my biggest concern is, and I'll liken it to your house. So you receive X amount of dollars in your own paycheck, and you make choices around what you need to spend money on. Most people will choose food and shelter, and they may defer things on their car or their house. And that's the same issue we're dealing with. You know, we're going to do everything we can to provide patient care. So we're going to leave as much of our patient care processes intact that we can. We'll make sure we have the right set of nurses and staff and doctors. Where we're going to struggle, quite honestly, depending upon what model ever comes out, is our ability to invest in our infrastructure. And so, therefore, some of our capital equipment needs may have to be deferred or delayed. So that's really the challenge. We just don't have the ability to invest more in our future. We're hoping to think, you know, as the region's level one trauma center, as a big source of the academic enterprise, training residents and nursing students and pharmacy students, we're hoping to think, get people to think of us more as an investment. And so when those formulas are challenging for us, then we don't have the ability to invest in our enterprise.
South Florida public hospitals like Jackson Memorial in Miami have cried foul about this, as you are. That hospital is saying under the Senate proposal, they'd lose $59 million as a major public Florida hospital. What would UF Health lose if the Senate plan is adopted?
I think the current models, we would lose $13 million.
$13 million, and how would you absorb those that loss to your budget? How would you react to that? As you said, just delay infrastructure improvements.
Most likely. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're going to do everything we can to protect patient care. And so we're going to look, obviously, at how we operate, our efficiency, how good we are as a system. But truthfully, we may have to delay some of the construction needs, or really, more importantly, some of the investment needs for the institution.
This is an issue that it looks at whether to scrap a long-standing system, a payment system for a new system. What they want to do is increase base Medicaid rates to every hospital, regardless of how many Medicaid patients the hospitals are accepting. Of course, Florida did not do the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. How much did that decision, in your view, factor into this current impasse or not?
You know, I'm still relatively new to the state, so I don't know how they landed with the decision that they did. I think the challenge right now is, you know, we have people who need care across the state, here in Jacksonville, obviously, in the other big cities, and how do you best take care of them? And so the Medicaid expansion, Affordable Care Act, was an opportunity to try and think about how to close the gap. Now that we don't have to close, now that the gap hasn't been closed, the question becomes, you know, how do you care for the patients? And so I think what the state is trying to do is figure out what's the best way to do that, what's the best formula. Unfortunately, the models that currently are being proposed obviously have a negative impact across the safety net.
All right, let's go to your calls now for Dr. Leon Haley, CEO of UF Health Jacksonville. The state legislature is not going to meet its deadline for the second year in a row and produce a budget for the state. Again, let me remind you, this is their only constitutional responsibility. That is literally the only thing they are sent to Tallahassee to do every year. And for the second year in a row, they're not going to get it done. the reason this time is this fight, this 11th hour dispute over how to fund the state's hospitals. UF Health is the region's only safety net hospital. What are your questions for CEO Leon Haley about this? 549-2937. Mike is on the south side. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is always sad hearing this kind of stinginess from our state government. That's there are poor sick people. They're not going away. They're a fact of life. They're a fact of our society. And I always get disheartened when it turns to these sort of issues where there's you made a good point about this being an investment in your community, so to speak. And I think we get, so focused on the price tag that we fail to look at what kind of investment there is with regards to this. But I guess my question is, do you think if we were to start calling our, is it too late to call our legislators or our representatives and say, hey, get off the dime on this. This is just, or is it too steeped in party politics to really do anything about it? And I guess that's where I'll leave my question. I'm interested in hearing your answer on it.
Thanks for that.
For Jacksonville people, who can we call? Thanks.
Bye. Okay, thanks for that. And it does need pointing out, Leon Haley, that the two leaders at odds over this, Mr. Negron and Mr. Corcoran, the leaders of the House and Senate, are both Republicans. So it's an intra-party fight. But what about Mike's questions?
I don't think it's ever too late to call your local legislatures and, ask them, talk about the role we play in this community, what the potential impact would be. Again, we're the region's only level one trauma center between here in Savannah and here out in Gainesville. So you're talking about over 1 million people that really depend upon our services, regardless of the ability to pay. And so I think there's an opportunity for our citizens to call their legislatures and say, this has some really significant impacts on our region.
Yeah, and the Duval legislative delegation, Mike, you asked about that. That's easily searchable if you just Google Duval delegation, Florida State Legislature, number of lawmakers, and you can look up your legislator in the district that you live in. And here's an email for you. The number to join the show, 549-2937. Jennifer emails the show from the South Side. Legislators are some of the only people I know that get paid for not doing their job. I wonder whether they would find a way to get a budget passed within the regular session if they were not paid for extra days for failing to do so. Leon Haley, they're going to go into Monday, maybe even Tuesday of next week, is my understanding over this. Isn't that right?
Yes, I think that's what we are hearing. Unfortunately, I'm down here in Jacksonville, not out in Tallahassee, but we do hear they may go into Monday for sure.
So you're in Tallahassee now. Are you there to lobby over this? What's your role here?
No, I'm in Jacksonville.
Oh, you're in Jacksonville. But how are the safety net hospitals making their case in the halls of Tallahassee at this time?
Well, we have people out there. I've been out there, actually. So I was out there during our safety net week a couple of weeks ago. We've had other CEOs there. We do have an organization called the Safety Net Alliance that has a regular presence in Tallahassee. We work very closely with them to advocate on behalf of the safety nets, which includes teaching hospitals, safety net, public hospitals, and some of the children's hospitals as well. So we're all in that same group. And so we do have a constant presence there that we try and lobby on our behalf.
Okay. And that Alliance of Safety Net Hospitals, the lawmakers that are going up against them are arguing that that the playing field needs to be leveled between the reimbursements toward your model and the for-profit hospitals model, that if you're taking these Medicaid patients, that you should all get reimbursed the same. And just so people are aware, that's the other side of the argument. Fair to say?
Fair to say.
And you don't agree with that, obviously, but that's the debate that's happening. Yes. Okay. And let's take a few more of your calls as we speak with Leon Haley. He's the CEO of UF Health in Jacksonville. What are your thoughts about this 11th hour dispute holding up once again the end of the state legislative session This fight is over how to fund the state's hospitals. George is at the beaches right now. Hi, George.
I think they're moving out of this damn town because we're sick and tired of taking care of people that are taking our children and grandchildren's jobs. We have to give them medical. We have to give them all kinds of stuff. You there?
We're here. Go ahead.
All right. But we have to give them the medical. We have to give them our jobs. We have to do that. I just had a roof put on my house. And the people were from Guatemala. And they were sleeping on my lawn for their siestas in the afternoon. And the roof was terrible. I had to bring another company in to finish the job.
Well, George, why do you think that those companies are hiring people from another country to do those jobs?
There's a lot of poor people in Jacksonville. Well, see, the thing is, what you don't understand is I worked for a construction company here about 25 years ago. And he hired a Mexican guy that I had to train how to drive a dump truck. And after 3 weeks of training on how to drive a dump truck, he came up to me and asked me how he was doing. I said, he's fair, but we have local guys a heck of a lot better than him. He says, well, the regular guy, I pay him $5 an hour, and he cost me $2.50. The reason why he cost me $2.50, at the end of the year, he got half his paycheck back as a tax deduction. So he said, after you get finished training him, I want to replace all 20 with Mexicans. So he said, you better do a good job or I'll replace you too. It's been going on like that for 25 years.
Well, and wouldn't you call that an exploitive situation for both the Mexicans and the American folks that aren't being hired? That's an exploitive situation, isn't it?
There's C&W dump trailers in Jacksonville, not in Jacksonville, I guess.
You're getting more into the immigration debate, George, but I understand your point because, and I appreciate your point of view, because certainly there are a lot of people in this area who are poor, who don't have health insurance, and they have to be treated.
Why don't you explain to people why the hell it's costing so damn much for these hospitals and stuff, and why don't you explain to people on the radio about why our children can't find jobs and all that kind of stuff. And he said, well, these people work harder. Well, what the hell when you can get two for the price of one? How the heck is our child going to
Okay, George, thanks for the call. Okay, Leon Haley, your hospital treats everyone. You know, I don't know if you'll like this reference, and maybe I'm dating myself a little bit when I talk about it, but when I was a teenager, there was this show on TV called St. Elsewhere. Remember that show?
I do.
Well, you're St. Elsewhere for Jacksonville. You know, now, not only are you opening your doors to everyone, you have the proton beam. UF's Proton Therapy Institute is world-renowned. People come from all over the world to be treated there for cancer and other ailments. You have a teaching hospital there that is world class. You have the region's only level one trauma center. You have a number of medical disciplines that are just unbelievably fantastic. And you know, you're doing great things with medical care at UF Health over on 8th Street, right here in Jacksonville. But you are also the place where poor and uninsured people go. And if somebody has suffered a severe traumatic injury, they go to Trauma One. So, you know, when we get a call like George's at the beaches and he's upset about poor and uninsured people, particularly undocumented immigrants, you know, certainly we've seen the politics of that play out in this country over the last couple of years. And we want to give voice to that anger on this show and everybody's point of view. At the same time, your job as CEO of UF Health is to treat those people. So can you explain to George, you know, how you see your role in all this and your responsibility and why you think this is so important for this community?
Well, I think you did a good job of explaining what we do. You know, we are the region's largest academic medical center. We provide outstanding clinical care in a number of areas, including trauma, neurosciences, cardiovascular disease. We have an extensive primary care network trying to provide primary care through a 5-county area and 2 counties in Georgia, actually. We have an extension hospital. We have a North hospital that we're continuing to try and grow. We provide teaching for residents, medical students, nursing students, pharmacy students, and we do research on this campus, about $21 million. And on top of all of that, you're right, we provide care to everybody who needs it. So, without getting into the whole immigration debate, obviously, everybody in the citizen has access to care, and we provide a lot of that access. We obviously, there's a significant portion of people who can't afford it or have trouble affording it, but we have to provide it. And so that's part of our mission. That's part of who we are, but we're also part of being a large academic center. So my only answer to him would be, you know, we all have to provide, we're in the business of providing care. We provide a significant role of safety net. We're an academic center. What we're hoping obviously is to work with the state to figure out what's the best models and formulas to try and support that care process.
Jay tweets the show, while it's true the legislature's only constitutional duty is to pass a budget, they still have to pass bills. That they only have a 60-day session may just be a little antiquated, given how much the state has grown. Thanks for that feedback, and let's take one more call. Andrew is in Riverside. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey there, Melissa. How are you doing?
Okay, thanks.
Good. I'm actually trying to hear you, and I'm on my fourth year of
having trouble hearing you, Andrew.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, I trained at UF Health and I'm fourth year faculty at UF Health in emergency medicine. Very proud to work there. First off, I want to thank Dr. Haley. He had huge shoes to fill when Russ Armistead retired, but I can't think of a better person to fill him other than Leon Haley. So in response to the previous caller, despite his inflammatory remarks, I think he brought up a big talking point. Emergency medicine trauma is the great equalizer. We see every walk of life. It's not just the poor and indigent. You can't imagine how many people suddenly lose insurance and suddenly are on our doorstep. They had a very good lifestyle, and now they're in our bed. Or they have to take one of our 3 helicopters to come to our institution when they're severely hurt. So suddenly they find us.
Yes, thanks for that. I don't think people realize the critical public health role UF Health plays, Dr. Haley. They wouldn't realize it unless calamity happened and you weren't there.
That's correct. You know, but again, we're trying to, you know, shift the mindset of the community that yes, we provide a significant safety net role, but we also are, again, sort of that academic medical center, you know, training, educating, and, you know, we'd certainly like to partner with the growth in the city and with downtown and think about, you know, how the academic medical center can be used as part of, you know, as we continue to build our city, you know, how we can use that leverage to, you know, attract people here and work closely with our other healthcare partners to make this an outstanding city.
We will continue to follow this as it winds its way through the missed deadline for the second year in a row. Huh. In the meantime, Dr. Leon Haley of UF Health Jacksonville, always great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Great. Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Sorry, everyone. I just believe in meeting my deadlines. I can't get away with missing them. Neither can Michelle Corum. She's smiling at me right now. Much more still ahead later, how the arts are taking center stage this month in the Duval County Public Schools. But up next, you know the old saying about a certain road being paved with good intentions? Well, we're going to speak with the author of the bestseller Toxic Charity. He's coming to town. His advice for helping our neediest citizens, that's next.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Highway, hospital, home, work, where negligence causes injury or death makes a difference in the law that applies and in the result. More at waynehogan.law.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
I'm going 120 feet underground.
You claustrophobic?
No, not really.
Okay, because we're going to be in this elevator for about a minute.
A minute later, a huge Titan II missile designed to carry a nuclear payload looms above me.
You need to keep your situational awareness.
Nuclear weapons and the threat of war on the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, vocalist Liz Wright takes us on a road trip from Appalachia to rural Georgia.
I decided to basically encircle my own, my life, and to go into a little bit of my parents. I just kind of literally drew a route through it all.
That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT. Keeps me singing in my soul.
Welcome back. Well, City Rescue Mission's third annual Difference Makers Banquet is coming up later this month, and the evening will feature a special guest, Robert Lupton, author of the widely read book, Toxic Charity. It's viewed as a groundbreaking examination of the way well-intentioned efforts to help the neediest people in a community can often boomerang, even have toxic effects. Here in studio with a preview, CRM Executive Director Penny Kivett. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And joining us by phone, Robert Lupton, founder of FCS Ministries and the best-selling author of Toxic Charity. Robert, good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Now, of course, you're famed for your work up in Georgia, moving from your house in the suburbs with your wife to the city, working to rebuild urban neighborhoods. You've done a lot around this. And in your book, Toxic Charity, you've really hit upon what might seem like some counterintuitive ideas about how to do this kind of work. What are some of the most important points you want our listeners to hear about your ideas about this when it comes to efforts to help the needy that you say can sometimes be toxic?
Well, first of all, we want to affirm the compassionate work that people of goodwill are engaged in. Our heart leads us into serving those who are less fortunate, and that we want to affirm. But in addition to following our hearts, we need to engage our minds, and sometimes our charity is not well thought through. Sometimes it can actually be hurtful to those we want to help.
For example, one way giving will tend to, certainly initially, is a
delightful surprise to folks. But by the second and third time, it starts to become an expectation, and then it becomes an entitlement, and then can lead to unhealthy dependency, which is not good for either the giver or the recipient. And so that would be an example of when giving is not reciprocal, when it's one way. There are dangers involved in that kind of charity. That's what I say. It can become toxic.
And then you wrote a follow-up called Charity Detox, where you came out with some ideas and solutions. You've put your money where your mouth is in your work. What are some solutions that you recommend for Jacksonville?
Well, certainly our experience has been if you set up a clothes closet, that can, again, if that's free giveaways, that can lead to some unhealthy dependencies. It can also erode a work ethic and diminish human dignity, and so we don't want to do that. We ended up replacing our food or our clothes closet with a thrift store where folks can come and purchase their clothing at very affordable prices. There's dignity in the process of exchange. Everyone has something of value to bring to the table. And so there's no loss of self-esteem in an exchange system like that. We'd do the same thing with food. Instead of the food pantry, we've set up food co-ops where folks, kind of like a buying club, where members contribute their share and enjoy the benefits of an exchange system. A grocery store, a good grocery store in a community of need, is a huge blessing. And so those would be examples of detoxifying the way we traditionally have done charity.
Excellent. Okay. Penny Kiewit, Executive Director of City Rescue Mission. The concept of dignity and an exchange seems central to what Robert Lupton has been doing in Atlanta. This is a short preview of what he'll be talking about at your event. And how are you incorporating some of these ideas into the work of City Rescue Mission?
Melissa, thank you so much for asking me that question. I've been chomping at the bit. I met Bob back in 2014 and actually brought him in for 2 days when I took over the role of his executive director at City Rescue Mission because I loved his book and I wanted to make sure that City Rescue Mission didn't become toxic or wasn't toxic. And so Bob has just been a real inspiration to me. How have we incorporated it? I completely changed the way that we helped serve the people that are homeless and addicted in Jacksonville so that they aren't treated like they that there are expectations. Rather, we want to make sure that that whole piece of dignity and respect is kept intact so that they can feel good about what they do and how mm-hmm. they do it and how they recover and how they give back to community. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, Bob has been inspiration to us as we have now purchased 14 homes and have started revitalizing North Riverside. So our goal is, as people come to us and lives are transformed, we're going to also transform a neighborhood in Jacksonville, and that's very important to the mission.
This is all excellent, and you're going to be honoring people doing this kind of work at your upcoming event.
We are.
Difference Makers Banquet. That's Thursday, March 22nd at the Lexington Hotel on the South Bank. Just go to crmjax.org. And so spotlighting some great people in this community, but also you'll have Robert speaking.
We do.
And so, Robert, you'll be talking a little bit more about these ideas at this event, which I think will be really enlightening for a lot of people that come out to hear you.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. The model that City Rescue Mission has established is it's a game changer. It's having an impact and influence on missions and other urban work literally across the country. So it gives me great pleasure to be able to trumpet their model and success.
All right. Tickets still available.
But they're going quickly.
Going fast. Robert's a big draw. Go to crmjax.org for City Rescue Mission's big event. Penny Kiewit and author Robert and Minister Robert Lupton, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa. And I'll see you soon, Bob.
See you soon.
We'll be right back.
Wouldn't it be nice to know what's in the local daily newspaper, even if you have blindness or diminishing eyesight? WJCT's radio reading service can help. You'll hear what's in the Florida Times Union every day, articles, op-eds, obituaries, even the comics. Sign up at wjct.org/radio reading. Our thanks to Florida Eye Specialists, Delta Gamma of UNF, and the Radio Reading Service volunteer readers for giving voice to the printed word.
Just because other people don't see it, doesn't mean it's not there. My next snap judgment. From WNYC, The Path. Snap judgment. Storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it.
Saturdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
WJCT offers a 24-hour classical music service dedicated to live classical music programming 24 hours a day. To find out more, visit us at wjct.org/hd.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon, the best in classic and modern blues, as part of WJCT's After Hours, tonight at 11 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, Mocha Jacksonville is kicking off its new season this spring with a Project Atrium installation by a Pakistani-American artist. Now, in her work, Anila Qayyum Agha explores the exclusion of women from the public domain. And she's also got a lot to say right now about the immigration debate. Anila joins us now along with Caitlin Doherty, Executive Director of Mocha Jacksonville. Good to see you both.
Good to see you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being with us. And I'm sorry, should I refer to you as Agha, not Anila? Is that right?
Call me by my first name, please.
Which is Anila. Okay. So this exhibit is called The Grays in Between, and it has to do with, you drew on a lot of inspirations, but part of it you drew on was your childhood in Pakistan and how women are not really welcomed in a lot of public spaces. Is that right?
Well, that was my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, artists draw from experiences that happen to themselves and their families and loved ones. And so when I think back on my childhood and then I think about what I'm doing currently, it sort of connects in different ways. And my work often deals with what is different and what is common between people of different types or different cultures or different backgrounds. So it's sort of, my work kind of is a contemplation of the way boundaries behave or the way humans interact with boundaries. And a lot of boundaries are like race, relationships, mm-hmm. or economics. So I kind of contemplate or investigate that moment of intersection.
You used laser-cut stainless steel sculptures, and so people will see these serene spaces, but also, as you point out, you're making a point about the lack of inclusivity,
mm-hmm.
that some people are in and some people are out.
Yeah, that's the nature of boundaries.
Yeah. And so how did you hit upon this method of using stainless steel to express what you're trying to say with this piece?
Well, what I was, to start with, the idea was to work with something that had flawlessness associated with it. And when you, it wasn't so much about the material at that point in time. It was about how I could make a structure that was really big, yet did all the things I wanted it to do, and have strength. So the contrasts were very interesting to me because steel is really heavy and strong and built to last. Yet with my sculptures, the structures actually seem very ethereal. They are levitating. They're very soft and fragile looking. So there's this underlying contrast, which I find very fascinating because humans are like that.
Hmm.
You know, women are like that. So I often choose materials that connect back to how I am working with my concept because in my opinion, content is like, so craft or structure or materials or process have to be subservient to the content.
Caitlin Doherty, people can come and see this installation being put together this week at Mocha. Absolutely. And then Friday night, it'll officially open. That's always been a cool part of this series you're doing at the Museum of Contemporary Art in the big atrium as people walk in. People can see it being made.
Yeah. Project Atrium is, I think, a unique space in that way, in that spanning three floors of our beautiful museum, and really often connecting those floors, in fact, you have what essentially becomes an artist studio for 2 or 3 weeks. And it's worth noting, especially because Anila just mentioned the idea of boundaries and of inclusion, or by contrast, exclusion. Our whole lobby area is free and open to the public. So we encourage people to come by, to spend space, to see these Project Atrium installations, which are site-specific installations, never have been created anywhere else before, but made specifically for our space, and to get a little, almost like a little peek behind the door. You get to look inside the artist studio, and by extension, often, inside the mind of the artist. You actually get to see the process of art creation, and that's something very special, I think.
You've been choosing some really provocative works and artists since you came to town to lead MoCA Jacksonville. What was it about Anila's work that attracted you and motivated you to ask her to come and do this installation?
Well, you know, we have a great curatorial team, and our curator, Jamie DeSimone, has been working very closely with Anila. I knew Anila's work from the past, but really kudos needs to go to our curatorial team for working years out very often to begin conversations. And that's what I think many people don't realize, is that an exhibition does not happen overnight or during a three-week installation. Rather, exhibitions that I would curate or Jamie would curate or that we would be working on together, very often our conversations have been going on for multiple years. In some cases, I know I've curated shows which have been a decade in conversation before ever they emerge as an exhibition. And that's something that I think is very, very special. And when the curator and the artist have a particular connection, I think some really magical work and exhibitions can emerge. And Project Atrium in particular allows that space for experimentation, for newness. And in fact, new to Anila's work this time round is the use of a darkening of the space, a very, very dark gray color, almost like charcoal on the walls, so that the space, you may remember the last installation, seemed very light and airy. In fact, we've now covered in our rooftop windows. We've darkened the entire space, and that will give an almost cavernous or enveloping sense, a sense of something foreboding, perhaps.
And as I'm looking at your website, Anila, your work is so beautiful. I think people are really going to be blown away as they come and view this. This officially opens on the 10th, but there's a public reception for the new Project Atrium, Anila Qayyum Agha, Friday, March 9th at 8 o'clock. Or you could stop by the museum this week and watch Anila at work, which is always fun. Mm-hmm. Or come on out and meet her and see the work Friday night. Go to MoCA Jacksonville's website for more. Thank you both so much for being with us. We appreciate it. And kudos on continuing such a great series.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Project Atrium series at MoCA Jacksonville, CEO Caitlin Doherty and artist Anila Qayyum Agha. And in a moment, more about the arts. We'll tell you why the Duval County Public Schools are highlighting the arts with your kids all month long. That's after this.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at waynehogan.law.
On the next Fresh Air, a return visit from John Oliver, the host of the HBO satirical series Last Week Tonight, on which he reviews the news of the week, then takes a deep dive into one story, which is always both really funny and informative. His approach has been described as investigative comedy. He first became known as a correspondent on The Daily Show. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Production speed is of the essence for companies trying to manage their inventories.
Right now, companies have to order 18, 24 months before the goods actually hit the floor, and it's so hard to predict what consumers are going to want.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, lasers and your Levi's jeans, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Jordan Peele has a lot to say, but he admits it took him a while to say it with his Oscar-winning movie, Get Out.
I kept coming back to it because I knew if someone let me make this movie, that people would hear it and people would see it.
His film is changing how we talk about race. A special retro meeting of our movie club discusses Get Out. Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Keep up to date with your favorite WJCT programs or listen to your favorite 89.9 FM shows online. Visit WJCT.org and explore a variety of programming content. It's just a click away. WJCT. Log on. Find out.
Welcome back. Well, Mocha Jacksonville is kicking off its new season this spring with a Project Atrium installation by a Pakistani-American artist. Now, in her work, Anila Qayyum Agha explores the exclusion of women from the public domain. And she's also got a lot to say right now about the immigration debate. Anila joins us now along with Caitlin Doherty, Executive Director of Mocha Jacksonville. Good to see you both.
Good to see you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being with us. And I'm sorry, should I refer to you as Agha, not Anila? Is that right?
Call me by my first name, please.
Which is Anila. Okay. So this exhibit is called The Grays in Between, and it has to do with, you drew on a lot of inspirations, but part of it you drew on was your childhood in Pakistan and how women are not really welcomed in a lot of public spaces. Is that right?
Well, that was my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, artists draw from experiences that happen to themselves and their families and loved ones. And so when I think back on my childhood and then I think about what I'm doing currently, it sort of connects in different ways. And my work often deals with what is different and what is common between people of different types or different cultures or different backgrounds. So it's sort of, my work kind of is a contemplation of the way boundaries behave or the way humans interact with boundaries. And a lot of boundaries are like race, relationships, mm-hmm. or economics. So I kind of contemplate or investigate that moment of intersection.
You used laser-cut stainless steel sculptures, and so people will see these serene spaces, but also, as you point out, you're making a point about the lack of inclusivity,
mm-hmm.
that some people are in and some people are out.
Yeah, that's the nature of boundaries.
Yeah. And so how did you hit upon this method of using stainless steel to express what you're trying to say with this piece?
Well, what I was, to start with, the idea was to work with something that had flawlessness associated with it. And when you, it wasn't so much about the material at that point in time. It was about how I could make a structure that was really big, yet did all the things I wanted it to do, and have strength. So the contrasts were very interesting to me because steel is really heavy and strong and built to last. Yet with my sculptures, the structures actually seem very ethereal. They are levitating. They're very soft and fragile looking. So there's this underlying contrast, which I find very fascinating because humans are like that. Mm. You know, women are like that. So I often choose materials that connect back to how I am working with my concept, because in my opinion, content is like, so craft or structure or materials or process have to be subservient to the content.
Caitlin Doherty, people can come and see this installation being put together this week at MoCA.
Absolutely.
And then Friday night, it'll officially open. That's always been a cool part of this series you're doing at the Museum of Contemporary Art in the big atrium as people walk in. People can see it being made.
Yeah. Project Atrium is, I think, a unique space in that way, in that spanning three floors of our beautiful museum, and really often connecting those floors, in fact, you have what essentially becomes an artist studio for 2 or 3 weeks. And it's worth noting, especially because Anila just mentioned the idea of boundaries and of inclusion, or by contrast, exclusion. Our whole lobby area is free and open to the public. So we encourage people to come by, to spend space, to see these Project Atrium installations, which are site-specific installations, never have been created anywhere else before, but made specifically for our space, and to get a little, almost like a little peek behind the door. You get to look inside the artist studio, and by extension, often, inside the mind of the artist. You actually get to see the process of art creation, and that's something very special, I think.
You've been choosing some really provocative works and artists since you came to town to lead MoCA Jacksonville. What was it about Anila's work that attracted you and motivated you to ask her to come and do this installation?
Well, you know, we have a great curatorial team, and our curator, Jamie DeSimone, has been working very closely with Anila. I knew Anila's work from the past, but really kudos needs to go to our curatorial team for working years out very often to begin conversations. And that's what I think many people don't realize, is that an exhibition does not happen overnight or during a three-week installation. Rather, exhibitions that I would curate or Jamie would curate or that we would be working on together, very often our conversations have been going on for multiple years. In some cases, I know I've curated shows which have been a decade in conversation before ever they emerge as an exhibition. And that's something that I think is very, very special. And when the curator and the artist have a particular connection, I think some really magical work and exhibitions can emerge. And Project Atrium in particular allows that space for experimentation, for newness. And in fact, new to Anila's work this time round is the use of a darkening of the space, a very, very dark gray color, almost like charcoal on the walls, so that the space, you may remember the last installation, seemed very light and airy. In fact, we've now covered in our rooftop windows. We've darkened the entire space, and that will give an almost cavernous or enveloping sense, a sense of something foreboding, perhaps.
And as I'm looking at your website, Anila, your work is so beautiful. I think people are really going to be blown away as they come and view this. This officially opens on the 10th, but there's a public reception for the new Project Atrium, Anila Qayyum Agha, Friday, March 9th at 8 o'clock. Or you could stop by the museum this week and watch Anila at work, which is always fun. Mm-hmm. Or come on out and meet her and see the work Friday night. Go to MoCA Jacksonville's website for more. Thank you both so much for being with us. We appreciate it. And kudos on continuing such a great series.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Project Atrium series at MoCA Jacksonville, CEO Caitlin Doherty and artist Anila Qayyum Agha. And in a moment, more about the arts. We'll tell you why the Duval County Public Schools are highlighting the arts with your kids all month long. That's after this.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.